The Power of Privilege and Allyship podcast showcases the positive impact of using privilege to maximize allyship and transform lives. Find out more about privilege and allyship by listening to this new podcast series. Hello, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to the Power of Privilege and Allyship podcast. My name is Funke Abimbola, and I'm the CEO and founder of the Austin Bronte Consultancy. The consultancy's main goal is to improve leadership by leveraging the impact of diversity, inclusion, belonging, and equity across the business world. Today, I'm truly delighted to be speaking to Robert Clark. Robert, welcome to our show.
Oh, well, thank you, Funke. Glad to be here.
So, Robert, we're dying to know all about you. So please, can you introduce yourself to our audience and tell us a bit more about you?
Oh, well, okay. So I'm Robert Clark. I am a Jamaican by birth. Grew up in the tiny Caribbean island, many thousands of miles away from the UK. That was back in the mid-70s. So I am, I would say, a child of the kind of post-independence era of coming out of a Commonwealth nation, island nation. And yes, I sort of grew up in the tropics, kind of pretty carefree type of, you know, growing up. One, number four of seven kids. So I'm kind of, yeah, used to, not in the middle, but, you know, doing my own thing. Just, yeah, really fun times, fun days of just running around barefooted on an island, no cares in the world, pretty supportive family. Yeah, just you're kind of back those days as a kid running around, you kind of, you started to dream, I guess, after primary school. You know, anything before that, the age of kind of 12, it's just like fun days. And then, you know, getting a bit more serious going into high school, started to think about life and the world, and now I have to start growing up. And then, yeah, just what you wanted to. So, you know, grew up, you know, went to the traditional high school system there, went to an all boys high school in the capital, in Kingston. And then after high school, what to do next? You know, yeah, 16, 17, you're the big wide world, you know, let's go for it. But of course, but having so many different influences back then, either it's the sport, I was very active in sport in high school, you know, name it cricket, football, basketball, whatever. I was just into it. I was football mad. And it was kind of a, I would say a constant struggle, but it was some interesting discussions with my mom around, you know, sport versus academics versus schoolwork, you know, what you want to do with your life and, you know, what's the next steps and all of that. So, you know, it was kind of, in a way, a crossroads when I got to mid-teens. I decided, oh, well, you know, of course, sport, yeah, you can have fun. Back then, playing football wasn't seen as a viable career option. So, you know, what I'm going to do to earn some money. So then I decided, I became interested in the kind of the STEM field in terms of mechanics and science and engineering, and started tinkering around with anything with that electronic circuit that I could take apart or put together or fix. Cars became quite a bit of a passion. I had a friend of mine who had an old garage, and I would be happy to be spent days there going through old car engines covered in oil and mud and dirt and everything, just fixing stuff. I just love to fix things. And then I kind of started to get interested in biology. You know, I remember back, you know, as a kid going around catching frogs and lizards and, you know, anything that moved, you know, I really started to, the science of life. And in a way, a little bit from, because my mom, that she was a nurse at the time. So I would kind of get her stories of coming home from the hospital, you know, looking after people who are ill and sick. I'm thinking, wow, you know, you just to looking after, just getting someone better. You know, why? Starting to ask, of course, science, you know, based on that is asking the questions, why, what is causing this? What is happening? Why is this person sick? Why, you know, what's, so this kind of really, and then my mom had a huge library of medical textbooks and started to get into reading about, pathophysiology and disease processes and everything. So that kind of almost propelled me in going into university. I decided, okay, yes, so science is kind of my thing a little bit. How do I mix that with the engineering, with the electronics? So then decided to, you know, move into lab technology, biomedical technology, where it kind of has that feel of machines and using automated lab systems, you know, with analyzing samples, diagnostics. And then that kind of really almost set me on a path into, what I'm doing now. Having moved or left, migrated from Jamaica into the UK. And then I decided, okay, now, so, you know, here I am. How do I leverage what I've done working in a lab, you know, 20 odd years there and coming into the UK? Now I decided, okay, so I developed this fascination with hearts, with cardiology. Started to look into going into medical school in the UK. Decided it was, well, so prohibitively expensive in terms of just the fees to go into med school. And then a friend of mine, she was working as a nurse, and she was like, why don't you think about going into nursing? Or like, what? No way. And then the more I started thinking about it, I'm thinking, well, yeah, it's something to do with my mom and with, you know, the hearts and cardiology. And decided to do my training, specialist training as a cardiac specialist nurse. Completed my residency in Canada. It's given the opportunity and the privilege to complete my residency there, and then came back to the UK, worked in the NHS about 5 years, and then an opportunity came up where I could move into the pharmaceutical industry in terms of drug research and development, and which is where I've been for the last 14 years in research and development, project management. So that's a kind of it in a nutshell.
Wow, you make it sound so seamless, Robert, honestly. And I,
but not the hard work, not the hard work in between, but it's been fun. It's been fun.
I just love the descriptions of Jamaica. I mean, it's I've never been to Jamaica. I've been to Barbados, but I've never been to Jamaica. And it just, it's a wonderful image of that sort of carefree lifestyle. And then you're following your passion, you know, within science. And then here you are.
It is a magical place. I've been to the other islands, so Barbados, Trinidad. But each island has, I guess every country would say they're the best in the world. But I think, being a bit biased, I think we have, not only because of the history, the music, you know, people think about Bob Marley, but the passion and the drive and don't worry, people think it's here, the first time a friend of mine says, what is this being? Don't worry about the thing. And so listen, man, when you've grown up in this carefree kind of tomorrow, we get it on. Sometimes I think we're probably a bit too laid back on the island, to be honest. It's like horizontal. Nothing gets done. Oh, yeah, the garbage is not collected. Oh, it will come tomorrow. Don't worry about it. So, you know, it can have, I think there's a balance there, of course, of, just being in a mindset of, you know, things will get better tomorrow. I think that's always been one of the driving principles in growing up, that tomorrow the sun will shine. And, you know, kind of looking back at even, just from you being a young kid running around the streets and having fun with tomorrow, we're very optimistic. It's a, Jamaicans are a very optimistic people. So we look forward to better. And it's a cool place to be. Very lively, just the culture, the food, the music, the people. Energetic, always something going on, so definitely well worth the visit.
I'd love to once lockdown restrictions are easier, you know, it'd be wonderful to go.
Definitely.
So what did you actually study at university? We have a number of young listeners who are thinking about different careers. So tell us a bit more about that.
So university, I went into biomedical technology. So that was my kind of core start into the STEM world, really. And this was really around lab diagnostics. And it kind of blended a little bit my interest in electronics engineering. I did electronics as part of my core degree. And it's, you know, a lot of the diagnostic systems are, you know, all automated. So it's, whether it's, you know, kind of a blood taking or blood analysis, blood gases, hemoglobin, even biochemical makeup of blood systems. So you have to have that kind of feel of what is going on with the machine in terms of even calibrating the system, but also having the biomedical side of it to interpret the results that you get. The machine is just one thing, but you know, you have to also have some manual processes behind that. So that's kind of core what I started out at university doing biomedical engineering and technology. And then moving into, when I moved to the UK and decided to move into the nursing field, you know, a nursing degree at the time was kind of my pathway into the medical clinical side of you know, looking after people with heart attacks, basically. You know, pre and post op, you know, people had you have a chest pain, don't know what's going on. You maybe call an ambulance, they take you into A&E, and that's where I started to work. You know, something's going on with the heart, whether it's a vessel being blocked, or what's the next step, you know, pain relief and trying to, you know, get that person better quickly. And in most of the cases, of course, you're under a lot of pressure. It's urgent, treatment's needed. So you have to be on your game to save someone's life. So that was kind of that interest for me anyway, around cardiology, and really how to help someone not only, you know, suffering from acute symptoms of cardiac disease, but even before that, the health promotion side of it, of, you know, healthy lifestyle, exercise, etc., you know, looking at risk factors and how to deal with prevention rather than the cure, which kind of almost fed a little bit into, you know, my master's degree when I studied at did public health later on. So that was kind of core in terms of my university experiences. And then, of course, moving into R&D, I also developed an interest in project management. So having gone on again to study core project management and methodologies and, yeah, how you run contracts and budgets and timelines and agile stuff. So, yeah, it's kind of a, you know, trying to bring together many different facets of really my interest that has kind of evolved and progressed over the years.
So now you work in project management for the world's largest biotech company. What does a typical day look like for you?
Well, so a typical day could look at starting with emails of whenever I log in to work in the morning, having my coffee on one hand, I'm thinking, okay, so what has gone wrong yesterday? So I'm in between kind of different time zones. I work with teams out in the Far East, in China, as well as to the far west in San Francisco. So I'm based in Europe, so I'm kind of in between the early starts with Shanghai and the later starts with San Francisco. So checking emails, you know, finding out what's going on a particular project. So it could be a new project setup, looking at contracts, looking at protocols, developing research materials, how much is this going to cost, what are the timelines, risk management, what are the risks involved, setting up meetings with the teams, clinical sciences or the later research, data management, you know, biostats. How do we get this project up and running? Then liaising with clinical operations guys. We are looking at this timeline. We have, you know, to deliver or get to know our first patients recruited. Our recruitment timeline is this. The data by this time, what is the end goal, or publications, you know, submissions, or regulatory submissions, etc. So it's quite a wide, you know, on the day, it just depends on that core part of it in terms of emails first, meetings, then maybe some follow-up action items after those meetings. And then it kind of starts the next day, you know, really. And is, you know, part of project management is planning, but also trying to be in control, empowering teams, you know, ensuring that people, you know, of course, everybody's busy, you know, you're trying to squeeze everything into a 24-hour day. And, you know, people are, you know, working on multiple projects at the same time, so resource constraints, trying to deal with that as well. So, you know, trying to kind of, I always think of project management as kind of like a, you know, the guy in the orchestra, or, you know, trying to, okay, this time, you know. And so you're orchestrating this, you know, huge teams across the world globally to try to achieve a single aim or a product. The daily job is has its ups and downs, but yeah, it's pretty interesting most of the times.
It sounds really, really good. And in getting to this point in your career, Robert, were there any specific challenges that you feel you had to overcome, and how did you overcome those?
I mean, challenges. Well, so I think one of the main challenges for me anyway, early, you know, as I said, starting out, it was one, being growing up on a small island, you're kind of geographically constrained in terms of, okay, you know, it's a small island, the resources are limited, your opportunities are limited. So, you know, when you kind of, being the kid I was, of dreaming big and wanting to travel and see the world, you're almost forced to, you know, move from a comfort zone, but, you know, safety net of being home to somewhere else where you want to try to achieve, and, you know, on a larger scale, see life and you know, to dream big. So the challenge, first of all, for me was one of being geographically located on a small island. When I came to the UK, I migrated to Europe. This was back in early mid-90s. Having to adjust, of course, to a different cultural, you know, the language was the same, English was quite good, but the cold and different weather, different food, a different cultural, you know, so that challenge was, of course, me kind of being here a little bit by myself. I had some family, but they were quite far, scattered all over north of the UK, and that, for me, being closer to London. So having to try to really adapt quickly to a new culture, new way of thinking, a new life, a new, regime, society. So having to do that kind of almost on my own, not having many friends around, or, you know, peers that I could ask or help or advise. So that was a particularly difficult few years to adapt and adjust. But then, you know, once you got in that kind of resilience, I think it's kind of been one of my main hallmarks as well. Never give up, you know, always try and keep going, just keep going. And then moving into academia or into industry, a lot of the, I would say, the challenge has been kind of trying to prove that I can do what I say I can do, type of thing. You know, it's less like, you know, when you're doing a CV or on paper, yeah, you can put all the fancy stuff, but, you know, to actually get into the working world and environment and having to prove this. And I think sometimes the challenge as you go up, especially in the commercial or the business side of industry, it's really, you know, having to each step of the way a little bit, having to prove each time that I can do this, you know. So, I mean, for me personally, I put a lot of pressure on myself to do 150%, maybe I'm my own worst critic. You know, I like to look back at a job that I'm doing or I've done and think, oh, how could I have done that differently, or could I have done that better or faster or more efficient? Or, you know, so I've kind of almost trying to pressure, put a certain level of pressure on my standards. I've always said I have quite a high standard in terms of what, oh, I see the work that I do and how I put myself forward and out there and keep that level high. And sometimes the motivation can go down and up, but it's trying to keep motivated, trying to keep pushing, trying to, you know, really have a goal and a mindset. So the challenge, in a way, it's kind of almost, yes, some external to a degree, but also for myself, the challenge, pushing myself each day to keep that same level of consistency up and, you know, at a certain level. So yeah, that's for me has been kind of one of the main challenges, I would say. Yeah,
and yet that has really formed you into this very resilient leader, as you say, which I'm sure is now a real strength for you in your career, Robert.
Definitely.
I mean, I would say so because I've known you for almost 10 years. So. No, that's absolutely wonderful.
Keep the level. To push yourself to keep at that level consistently, right? So it's kind of a marathon rather than a sprint. You know, sometimes the journey is there and you have to keep moving and, you know, look at some of the top athletes or the top business people or the top, politics or wherever. You know, it's just really just the consistency, you know, year in, year out, every day, you know, having that, just really keeping the bar high, I would say.
Oh, that's amazing. So we've started sort of touching on privilege and what that might mean. But in your own words, Robert, what is your understanding of privilege and how has that sort of manifested in your life?
For me, when I think about privilege, first of all, I think about someone at a certain, you know, royalty or someone being high up or born with, back home would have this expression, a gold spoon in their mouth. Having everything laid out on a plate, you know, privilege, you know, your entitlement, you're entitled to, you know, this. But then I been, you know, coming back to a context or my lived reality in a way that I think I'm actually privileged to be where I am at right now. Of course, we try not to compare ourselves to others. This COVID thing has just kind of thrown the entire world on its head. But to be, you know, in a place where it could have been worse. But I think, at the core, privilege is maybe starting from a point of, having a kind of, not immunity, but a position of being in a better place, I would say, than someone else who may not have that opportunity or may not have the wherewithal or the, you know, whether it's money or whether it's social status, you know. But yeah, I think it's really almost depends on, from an individual perspective, context, time and place, and how someone sees privilege. Because I guess in some ways, people naturally maybe compare themselves where they are now to someone who may have a lot or have plenty to someone who doesn't not having the opportunities, as I said. So it's really, for me, it's really one domain of looking at, oh, someone's rich or powerful or, wow, they are really in this privileged position. They're like, some high-flying person that's, you know, really is almost lives in a different world from the normal day-to-day, you know, whether it's royalty or, you know, some presidential prime minister's position. But then, yeah, for me, in the context of being privileged, of being in a position, I think that I am able to, whether share my story, like we're doing now on our podcast, or being in that, you know, where I can help or give some advice, or even if I'm not financially rich or super wealthy, but how can I share this opportunity, I think for me is the word of being in a position of where I am now. Right? So
that's wonderful. I like that. I like that sense of privilege is something that you can acquire over time, and it's not a rigid thing, and also contextualizing it as well. Yeah. And I really, really like that. So how do you think that allyship comes into this, and what does allyship then mean to you?
So, allyship, I guess it's, in a way, it is building on that opportunity thing. It's how do I use where I'm at to fight or to help someone who's not in the position that I am, or my profession, my position from being, you know, if I call it privilege, to really unlearn relearn what I've been taught over the years, to try to connect with someone in a position who may feel disempowered. And how do I use what I have now, my resources, to help or to connect or empathize with that person, said from the level that they are, who may have been, maybe historically, socially, economically, racially, disempowered. Communicate this, as I said, this notion of working at it, earning the privilege, being thankful for it, but also kind of trying to spread that privilege a little, you know, almost pulling the person up as well, but showing that through hard work, through sacrifice, through commitment, through resilience, tenacity, you know, and it's difficult to keep going, right? But I think that's part of the privilege linked with allyship, you know, to move that person from that place of disenfranchisement or disempowerment to say that, I connect with you, I understand what you're going through, you know, but let's work on this, let's come on this journey together. And, you know, from my position, helping that person to, you know, expand their mind. And as Bob Marley said, from mental slavery into a place of, mentally freeing themselves and looking for a better tomorrow, I think, to be honest. I think it's really links both privilege and allyship.
It's always a great discussion when we can bring in Bob Marley. You know, I love Redemption. That's from the
Redemption
song. That's my all-time favorite Bob Marley song. The lyrics are incredible, aren't they?
It spans generations. It's like, you know, have it been recorded, I think, back in the 70s, but it could be on for another 100 years, you know. And how do you, emancipation, right? That freedom. You know, I think we all, to be honest, I guess, everybody's maybe feel that they're maybe trapped a little bit, but how do we emancipate ourselves? That person having the ability or the tool set or the skill set to do it ourselves rather than maybe relying on someone else, you know, or emancipating yourself from mental slavery. None but to ourselves can free our minds. It's
our
crazy.
Mind,
it is power. That's the power of the mind, right? That's the power.
It really
of the mind.
Is.
Yeah, the guy was a prophet. Yeah, truly.
He
truly
honestly, absolute genius. I've always been a big fan of Bob Marley. Yeah. Completely incredible. Very, very inspiring words. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, isn't it, Robert? Because we both used to work for the same company, and growth mindset was a massive, massive focus. Wasn't it? But again, that links in to what Bob Marley was talking about years ago. The mental
side of it. Pressure is there. The pressure is always there to perform, to deliver, to produce. But it's the individual. You don't depend on systems or processes. You do this every day, consistently, day in, day out. And it takes a lot of work, right? A lot of energy, a lot of hard work. And but I think for me, part of it has also been working smart, not only working hard over the years, is really having a goal, driving towards that goal, but also being smart enough to know when to pivot, when to stop, take a break, just look and, left, right, you know, take some thinking time, again, the mental side of it, to get the energy to move again. And, you know, not being afraid to fail and to see every failure, learn from that, and just keep going, getting stronger and stronger. And that's what, builds us, mentally, physically, and to keep going.
Incredible.
Powerful words.
Very powerful words. How does diversity and inclusion fit into this? I know you're very, very passionate about diversity and inclusion, but why do you think it's so important, especially in the corporate world?
So, great question. I think, D&I, diversity and inclusion, it's really fits into, this, privilege, allyship, and bringing those two pieces sort of almost together in a way where, for me, D&I is about a level playing field. If there can ever be such a time in our history, that we have this between, no matter what you know, your color, your race, your religion, your gender, you know, sexuality. It's really as human beings. And again, it comes back down to, you know, the philosophies of, maybe even going back to Bob Marley, and really, I judge a man by, you know, what you can see rather than the content of his character. If Martin Luther, you know, these guys, it's that kind of thinking of really giving, starting the race. You know, I've always said, you know, to my kids, know, like, yeah, imagine Usain Bolt on the 100-meter line. Of course, he's very fast, but, you know, if you put him 50 meters or 100 meters behind, no matter how fast he is, with all his skill set and his tools that he has, if the other guys are 200 meters in front, the race is all before he even started, right? So you have to give young kids, you know, people on that spectrum of, this is the ability, these are the tools, but the same chances, the same opportunities. Unfortunately, you know, the world as it is right now isn't fair, it isn't level as, you know, historically and you know, where we are, our current reality is there are disproportionate, you know, inequalities and social injustice and, you know, racial and economic and health inequality. Just really, it's an unequal world that we live in. And it's really this, that, you know, for me, D&I, even in the corporate space, in the corporate world, there's been a lot of talk, especially over the last few years now. I know that it's really gained traction of innovation, this talk of, you know, for me, innovation, of course, comes with diversity of ideas as well. And having people from different backgrounds, from different, you know, life journeys and color and creed and everybody has come and putting all those ideas into the pot. I think for me, that's how you innovate, not having the same generic understanding or thinking of, yeah, this is how we have always done it. But if you want to change from one level that we are at now to a different, you know, we need the creative power of many different minds and different ways of seeing problems and things. And yeah, how to, and it's really a common thread in the work I do now in projects and you know, agile ways of thinking around project management, is really how we bring people with different ideas around the table at the same time. You know, ideas, how do we fix problems? How do we solve problems even before they exist? How do you, you know, come up with creative solutions and ideas? And for me, for you know, big business, corporate industries, yeah, it's really harnessing that talent from different, as I said, different backgrounds, different, you know, from a diverse population that, yeah, if you want to serve the public as the industry that we are in terms of, being a public service, you know, the public is made of, diverse, you know, diverse markets and countries and you know, so yeah, it's just really for me, just really how corporations, rather than, you know, there's the talk around it, but also the practicalities and the concrete, having the concrete steps involved, you know, to say that this is, we are taking this seriously, this is what we want to do and to drive growth, not only for the industry itself, but also, you know, for the betterment of society and mankind. So, yeah, I think D&I is, you know, super important. If, you know, more so even now, you know, with all of the inequalities we have been hearing about, you know, this COVID crisis has kind of thrown up a lot of uncertainties, you know, people losing their jobs, people's health care, people, you know, people are more worried, more stressed. And yeah, it is really, this is going to, I think, drive a lot of the way business looks and thinks in the future, as they keep saying, you know, cliche, new normal. But yeah, it's really going to just really change the way we even individuals interact with each other, right? Even at the individual level and communities. And this is going to have to translate into how, you know, corporations and governments and big business work together to, yeah, what sort of society do we want post COVID? Hope that things will get better and has to get better, and how will that look, in the future? Yeah. So D&I is going to be a really core part of this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So true. And so before we wrap things off, I've got to go back to Jamaica because I've never been there, Robert, and you've told me so many great stories, but tell me more about your hut. We need to know about this hut of yours that you have in Jamaica.
Fresh fried. I don't even want to release the where it's located because that But to me, it's the, I know it's, again, cliche, hiding life and this relaxing thing. For me, it's home. Whenever I go back home, it's home. And being home, it has a special place in my heart. So I like the sea. I like fishing. And for me, going back to my special spot where I can, nothing fancy, nice restaurant, wooden hut. I go in, I choose my nice fish. I have it cooked. I'm sitting under a tree, looking out to sea. I'm drinking a nice drink, cool, refreshing. It's a different place. And I go back to the mental health side of it. It gives you space and time to think. And to me, there's nothing, a connection, having been grown up by the sea, the connection there, it's something timeless. Things will change, time, people change, but the sea keeps coming in and out, the waves keep coming, crashing. So it's just really something that, you're looking out to sea, it's really nobody around. I mean, this place is just super off the beaten tourist track. So yeah, I'll give you some tips on how to get there, get lost. But yeah, this place is just something special. It is definitely somewhere special. And for me, it's my thinking place. I like fishing. And to me, I wouldn't say I'm a particularly good fisherman, but, I have a philosophy. I didn't put a fish in the sea. So if I take one out, I get it. So it's, for me, it's just time, spaced out time. Even if I go all day and I don't catch a thing, I'm happy to be by the sea. Sometimes I'm either by myself or with some good friends, or we have a chat, we have a laugh. Hey, we go in our little restaurant, we have some fish, we have a nice cold beer, and yeah, it's a good day. It's and these are the simple things, right? As I say, it's no 4-star, 5-star. It's just really back to basics. That is why I like, that's barefooted, feet in the sun. It is, to me, back to basics, back to where I started to dream as a kid, growing up on the island. And yeah, it's just really, it has that magical thing of, yeah, really taking it back in time. I think it's timeless. And it is just like, yeah, for me, this really connects, look at where I'm coming from to where I am at now. And a part of that is also giving thanks, right? Being, again, back to privilege, being thankful and grateful and for the blessings and that privilege to be in a position where I am compared, maybe, yeah, which, I know we shouldn't compare ourselves, but, it could be worse. And for me, in those moments, I'm thinking, well, this is to have that opportunity to be able to travel, to see the world, to come back to a small beach, sitting with friends, having a laugh, having a chat, the sun going down, it is magical. It's a special place. Yes, definitely.
Wow.
Yeah, don't worry, Funky. I'll give you some tips. And as I say, I hope you don't get lost. But once you arrive, but the tip is that you can actually see the planes coming into land in Kingston from the beach. So it is. Wow. So that's a good tip. You can actually see the planes coming into land.
Thank you so much, Robert. Honestly, I've really, really enjoyed our conversation. I'm actually, in my mind, I'm transported to Jamaica now. It's amazing. Wonderful.
It's been my pleasure, honestly. Great talk. And just sharing my story a little bit with yourself and with your listeners as well. And hopefully inspiring someone today, maybe to think post all of this crazy COVID thing, and just to find a place where they feel at home and where they can switch off. And I think the downtime is something that we are all looking forward to right now. Right? It's just been just such a crazy year and a half, 2 years, I don't know. But at a point, again, going back to the optimism and looking forward to a better tomorrow, that the sun will shine one day, being in a place where, yeah, we can dream and we can think, well, you know, that is a, you know, somewhere I really like to go, where just to find that place, you know, and it could even be somewhere here in the UK or, you know, locally, where it's quiet and kind of switch off from emails and, you know, cell, laptop, deadline, timelines, projects, contracts, budgets, you know, and just, yeah, just really feel like almost at peace, at one with nature. And yeah, maybe try and throw in a little bit of Bob Marley in the background and you're it transports you to a different place, man.
Oh, that is fantastic. Thank you so much again, Robert. Really, really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Yeah, it's great. And to our lovely listeners, thank you again for faithfully following us. You've sent through feedback, suggestions. You're really showing us the love. So we're feeling the love on these podcasts. And I look forward to my next conversation with another truly inspiring leader. But until then, I'll leave you. Stay safe and well. Thank you very much, everybody. And goodbye.
One love.